Welcome back, everybody. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I want you to join us here. Our guest this hour, for the entire hour, is Kevin Kamenetz, who is, of course, the Baltimore County Executive. Kevin, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Good morning.
Y'all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can email us, talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Go to our Facebook pages. But do call in, 410-319-8888. Got a couple of emails already from people here. But email us, talk@steinershow.org. Talk to us, 410-319-8888. Whether you live in Baltimore City or you live in Dundalk or you live in Towson or Pikesville or wherever that may be, give us a call, 410-319-8888. A lot, I could say, I need all the towns of Baltimore County. We have no time for questions. So
it's time to play ball yet.
What time does the game start?
3 o'clock. 3 o'clock, opening pitch.
There you go. Well, I won't be there this year, but that's okay. Where do we begin? Let's begin someplace where I didn't think I was going to begin, but I'll begin anyway. You and Congressman Van Hollen have called on Governor Hogan to make it clear what he thinks about this election and Donald Trump. So tell me what motivated that and why. What was that about?
Well, look, I think we're just having a little fun with him, quite frankly.
Fun?
Sure, sure. I mean, look, it's a fun election watching these Republicans. A little scary. I kind of thought with Donald Trump running, it's like manna from heaven for the Democrats. But now I had this fear that he could actually win. So I better watch what I wish for.
But this didn't sound like it was that kind of silly a question to ask the governor where he stands in this election. I mean, he's come out for Governor Christie when Christie was
he's trying to have it both ways. He takes off for a week on state time to go campaign in New Hampshire for his buddy Governor Christie, and then all of a sudden he's disgusted with presidential politics and doesn't want to tell us whether he's going to support Trump as the standard bearer. Sure, he's got to take a position. He can't have it both ways. And quite frankly, Trump, if he's the standard bearer and Governor Hogan's one of the rising Republican stars in the country, it'd be interesting to see what his position is. This is the time to stand up and be counted.
So have you endorsed anybody for this election?
For which election? Which
race? Democratic nomination.
I'm supporting Hillary.
You're supporting Hillary?
Yes.
And for the Senate?
She hasn't asked me, but I'm you're the first one asking me, and I'm telling you, you got a scoop now.
So here's a question I have about that. Another national political question for you before we get down into the dirt of Baltimore and Baltimore County and our communities. I meant that in a positive sense. So you're a superdelegate, right?
Yes.
Do you think it's time to end superdelegates? I mean, a lot of people really do believe that it is one of the most undemocratic processes inside the Democratic Party.
It's not. It's actually a small percentage of the overall delegates.
But it could make a difference in the election when people want to say, want somebody else nominated. It's that close. These superdelegates who are not elected by us to be delegates are telling the rest of the country who should be the nominee for the Democratic Party.
Well, I think what it is a recognition that there's a balance, that you have popular votes as well as those party officials who participate in the nomination process. It's always been that way. In fact, the pendulum has swung to give greater emphasis toward the popular vote. But if you think about 1968 and before then, it was really the party leaders who had greater sway.
But
the caucus process, you know, that takes place, that's not particularly democratic. I mean, you have to commit to hours at a time on, you know, sometimes a working day
caucus is crazy.
And then you could be persuaded by someone else. So I don't find that particularly the most democratic process either. So it's a blend of all three of those things. I think it works out.
But so just one final thing, then we get into Baltimore County here. We've had this discussion a lot, and somebody came to me I was lecturing yesterday at the Baltimore Ethical Society. The guy was there, and he asked a question. He came to me later to talk about superdelegates. And there's a big push in some of their parts, in people's parts, to end the superdelegate process, period. So it's a popular vote. I think caucuses are also anti-democratic. I don't think they don't give working people a real chance to be part of the process.
I agree.
I completely agree with that. But it just seems it gives the kind of the quote unquote heavyweights who too much power in the process.
Well, listen, ultimately, party insiders want to make sure that our party prevails. So part of that is using some wisdom as to not only who can win the nomination, but who can win the general election. I support Hillary because not because I dislike Bernie. I think that he has he's been very candid, blunt in terms of focusing on issues that have not been discussed in an open way, and I applaud him for it. I think people are attracted by his blunt appeal. However, I also have to look at who, as a party leader, who I think will win in the general. It doesn't do us any good to nominate George McGovern in 1972 and get trounced by Richard Nixon. It's the same thing here. We want to make sure that we have a candidate who is the most experienced, and I think that, quite frankly, Hillary is. She has great background, obviously a White House, first-hand White House experience, but also as a United States Senator and as Secretary of State. I think she offers a picture of competence, and especially against a potential Trump nomination, that issue of competence, I think, will be a very important factor in people's decisions.
All right. Let's get down into Baltimore County and in Maryland state politics and more. 410-319-8888 is the number to call to join in on this conversation. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Email me here at talk@steinershow.org. One email has come in, which I'll read in a moment. But do call in, 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts and ideas for Kevin Kamenetz as he joins us once again to take on his constituents' questions and more. 410-319-8888. So Bernard writes in here. I'll start with his email since it came in first, and I'll go to my own questions. A lot of county residents, especially activists, have looked to you, Kevin Kamenetz, to bring an era of balanced growth to Baltimore County, especially because you had protected Pikesville against inappropriate development by the very powerful developer Howard Brown. Instead, we now believe that you are making a bid for developers' contributions for a future gubernatorial run by having brought back Arnold Jablin, who's always been known as way too developer-friendly. Further development reorganization under you has consolidated almost all development under Jablin, known for years to side with developers over communities. Activists have seen a record disregard for whatever development laws that communities have fought to get passed through lack of enforcement and through the zoning department's granting of exceptions of all kinds, including variances in violation of state law, which require that minimum standards and must be met by granting exceptions of any kind in Maryland. So,
obviously a member of the Arnold Jablin fan club and quite a neutral and objective email here. Look,
I've heard a lot of people have negative things to say about Arnold Jablin and his work in Baltimore County and what he's been doing so far, no matter where I go. It's just, right, well, it's not a small club.
I guess when you've been in government service almost your entire life, like Arnold has, you win fans and sometimes upset people. But Arnold is a great public servant, has served virtually department heads, county attorney. He's really done it all throughout many different administrations, and I'm proud to have him add his institutional knowledge to this administration, which, by the way, has been going on for 6 years now, and I haven't read of any scandals whatsoever, notwithstanding that email, that are linked to Arnold Jablin or the county itself. In fact, what has happened in the county is that we have always been a jurisdiction that is environmentally friendly. Two-thirds of our county is zoned rural in nature, two-thirds geographically, and is on well and septic and has some of the most conservative zoning in the country. The the urban-rural demarcation line, is 49 years old this year, and we obviously have always promoted that concept where 80% of our population live on 30% of our land. At the same time, we are also a county that is fiscally well managed. We haven't raised the property tax rate in 27 years. We haven't raised the income tax rate in 23 years. And that record of fiscal stability can only be maintained if we expand our tax base. And the way we are expanding our tax base is logical. Downtown Towson, which is inside the Beltway, closest to the city line, has seen $1 billion of private investment in the last 5 years. That helps the county. The Metro Center in Owings Mills is built on the parking lot of the subway system and is the region's first true transit-oriented development. That's a $500 million project and, again, generates jobs and revenue for the county. So what we try to do is have controlled growth in areas where we think it makes sense and where there's existing infrastructure. But by and large, the county is pretty well built out. There's not new opportunity for housing developments in a grand scale anymore. So it's really trying to figure out how we have redevelopment in areas that make sense.
So I'm curious, this is a question came up here on the show the other day, and it's not directly about Baltimore County, but it is. You know, there's a huge battle going on in Baltimore City over the development. Kevin Plank, who's a Baltimore County resident, but has his
and we're grateful for that. That also helps maintain our values and our tax base.
To get this huge TIF for Port Covington, and part of the argument is being made here, and I'm not asking you to take a position on a city matter, but I'm asking this question about one thing that was said in the program when that debate was taking place was that Baltimore County doesn't have TIFs and pilots. So, A, why? B, what is it that allows Baltimore County to develop and do things without giving TIFs and pilots to billionaire corporations where Baltimore City is forced to, or well, seems to be forced to?
Yeah, it's a fair question. We have not used a TIF. We do have pilots, payment in lieu of taxes, but we generally reserve those for affordable housing, and we've done it for most of our senior projects where there's a lump sum payment as opposed to the current assessed value of the property. A TIF is an interesting concept because sometimes, and if I can just explain it quickly, I'll do the best I can here. Basically, if there's public infrastructure as part of a development project, the TIF is basically the city or the government floating a bond to the developer to pay for the public infrastructure improvements, that is the roads and the sewers and so forth, that are going to be owned by the city or by the jurisdiction. And then the developer pledges to use property tax revenue to pay off the bonds. So any increase in assessment above the current value as a result of the development, that extra property tax revenue is actually just used to pay off the TIF. The benefit for the developer, of course, is that the developer isn't fronting the money for the city infrastructure needs. The downside for the city and the benefit for the city is, of course, you have this whole new tax base that is being developed. And then after the TIF bond is paid off, then that's the city gets all of that increased tax revenue. But that's 20 or 30 years later. The downside is that the city is actually paying a higher rate of interest. TIF bonds are speculative, and frankly, jurisdictions can borrow their own money directly at a much lower interest rate. So, I guess if I were looking at it, I would have to examine, well, should the city just come in and build the roads themselves, float their own bonds to do that infrastructure work, and just require the developer to pay the normal property tax? That's one way of looking at it. Another way is just saying, okay, why don't I, maybe we should split or negotiate it, you know, have some percentage so that there's increasing tax revenue to the city at the same time. In Baltimore County, we don't do TIFs. We required the developers to actually build all of the public infrastructure by and large and then deed it over to the county. We have not had this type of project, however. We have not had a $3 billion proposal to come into Baltimore County. And obviously that the sheer size of that plus the gravitas of having Under Armour in this location and the spinoff that it's going to create, those are all kind of game changers too, which allow for this conversation.
So I wonder if that would happen in a place like Sparrows Point.
Well, we don't think Sparrows Point needs it there. We have developed and that's a great question. We have developed a blueprint that the ownership now has adopted, and we always viewed, and just again by way of history, Sparrows Point, when Bethlehem Steel was in its heyday, there was 25,000 direct jobs plus a large number of indirect jobs. When RG Steel closed in 2012, it was just 2,000 jobs. So our goal was to try and figure out how do we create that next generation of jobs, because steelmaking has really come to an end here. So we decided that it's the land that's the real asset there. It's 3,000 acres of land that's already zoned industrial in nature. It has deep water port access, plus access to two interstate highways and two rail lines. So we thought, well, the biggest economic engine in the state right now is the Port of Baltimore, and Sparrows Point would be a logical expansion point for the port. So it's not... We, as opposed to the area being distressed, so to speak, we feel the asset has great value already, and therefore, while we have certain incentives, enterprise zones and foreign tax credit zones that we've set up there, we don't think it needs that type of benefit for a TIF.
Your thoughts for Kevin Kamenetz, county executive from Baltimore County, here in the studios at WEAA on the Mark Steiner Show, 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Send us an email to talk@steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. Let's go to Dickens on line two. You're on the air. Welcome. Dickens, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, I'm here. Dickens.
Dickens, yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was calling them. I wanted to comment about, I'm just finding out about what the Port Covenant Project and their taxes. What's going on with their taxes, paying $1 a year? Under Armour, with this project?
Right, but I'm sorry, Dickens. That's been a topic on the show a lot. We just raised it to get the county perspective for a moment because the county executive is on from Baltimore County where they do not have TIFs. So that's why we asked him why they don't have TIFs in the county where we have them in the city and what could be the alternatives. But we'll stay tuned and stay with us because we're going to come back to the question of TIFs in the coming weeks because it's being voted on by the Finance Committee here in Baltimore City, then has to go to the City Council for approval and then comes back to the mayor's office. And she has to approve it first before all this stuff goes on. So we're going to come back to that as soon as we do know more. Let me get to a couple of issues here that I think that are – interesting, and it's a contradiction here or not. The Sun actually reported you're raising water and sewer fees over the next couple of years for infrastructure. We'll talk a bit about that. But at the same time last year, the stormwater management fee was pushed out. To me, that seems like a slight contradiction on one hand, but yes and no. I mean, we need the infrastructure. The entire state needs the infrastructure. So that's what just happened. But this whole question about the quote-unquote rain tax that has been voted out, and we saw the most recent reports coming in on the stormwater runoff that comes out of the county and the city into the bay and into the rivers, is what that stormwater management fee was supposed to take care of in the beginning. So how do you respond to that as county executive?
Well, the
disasters actually – environmentally we're actually facing at the moment.
They're related issues, but they're actually two different sections of the same concept
right,
here.
Right.
The stormwater management fee, also known as the rain tax, was designed because of a settlement of a suit brought on by the Chesapeake Bay Foundation against the state and the federal EPA, and the state agreed that the state had not yet fulfilled its responsibilities as required under that law, under the 1972 Clean Water Act. The state then set certain parameters in consent with the EPA and then told the counties, all right, the 10 largest jurisdictions, this is now your problem in terms of reducing runoff that leads into the Chesapeake Bay and to mitigate that runoff. The county said, well, we don't have the ability to pay for that. And the state said, okay, well, we will pass this rain tax law that requires you to impose that separate fee. And Baltimore County took it very seriously, and we developed $24 million a year of annual projects that we thought over the next 10 years are going to help us meet that nitrogen reduction runoff criteria. Governor Hogan ran against what he called the rain tax and falsely claimed that we're the only jurisdiction, only state in the country that has a rain tax. Of course, there are more than 20 states that have that requirement. But what he did was he poisoned the air such as it was to suggest that this was not something that had value. And of course it had value. And the idea of raising funds for a dedicated amount that achieves these goals would ensure that this would be prioritized. But you know, the electorate spoke, and then he was insistent on making sure that the obligation to impose a rain tax was repealed, and in fact it was. That didn't mean the obligation to do the cleanups for each of these counties was repealed. We still had the obligation, but I knew the fervor was out there that somehow this was a bad thing, and Baltimore County Council did repeal it. That requires us to dip into our general fund for $24 million a year to try and find or to fund, and we have an obligation, and we take it very seriously, to do things like planting trees, rebuilding stream beds, even street sweeping is a great methodology. But what we're doing now is completing those projects. That has nothing to do, however, with the metro fees. Interestingly, in 1924, the General Assembly passed the Metropolitan District Act, which created a regional water supply system that is owned and operated by the city of Baltimore, right. But the primary reservoirs are located in Baltimore County, in which we, because of our conservative environmental practices, make sure that those streams and tributaries leading to the reservoirs are well-maintained and pure. However, the law states that the Metropolitan District Fund has to be self-supporting. So what we do is every year on the property tax bill is add a sewer charge. You get a monthly or a quarterly bill from the city for the usage, but then there's an annual charge for the infrastructure needs. I liken this to preventing – so in order to maintain that separate funding that has to be self-supporting, we've had to adjust the rates, and that's quite the reason we have to do that, of course, is that our pipes and sewers are 50 years old. And the reason you see water main breaks, sinkholes, accidental discharges of sewage into the streams, those happen on occasion because of the age of the infrastructure. We entered into a consent decree in 2005 that the city and the county would provide significant upgrades to prevent this from happening, and that's why we've had to raise those fees. But I liken it to a Flint situation. We're never going to have a Flint situation happen here based upon our infrastructure or our attention to infrastructure, and I think that's what's important.
Let me open the phones, folks. Come on, wherever you live, Catonsville, Towson, Pikesville, Randallstown, Cockeysville, Dundalk, Sparrows Point, Turner Station, 410-319-8888. Your questions for Kevin Kamenetz, County Executive for Baltimore County. 410-319-8888 is the number. Let's go to the phones and go to William in Cockeysville. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Mark. How are you doing?
Very well. Good morning, William.
Good morning. Morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
How are you? Kevin, this is my question. Percentage-wise, specifically for the African-American community, all the work that's being done in the Towson and the county, how much has been designated to the African-American contractors per se?
And while he answers, William, hold on in case you have a follow-up. Go ahead, Kevin.
That is private development, so we are not involved in that other than encouraging our contractors to participate in our MBE program. But we have a WMBE set-aside that is very aggressive. We've been working very hard to make sure that we are meeting those goals, and I want to think we're in the 25% range, and I wish I had that stat there, but we monitor that, and those are in terms of county contracts. So we work very hard to achieve those goals. Although they are voluntary, we're pretty close to achieving them.
William, would that answer the question?
That'll suffice, Mark. I'm not going to get into more depth because I'm sure it's going to be more questions. But there's a part B of something else. I never had a personally problem with Kevin. I call him Kevin because he is as allowed to me. I'm a former Baltimore County employee, and I would see him each and every day as he entered Towson, because I worked at Towson and maintained the grounds at Towson and around, so forth. But I I had to ask this, and I can ask it now as a private citizen of Baltimore County. When you made the statement and Mays Chapel set up and to the senior citizens, how do you feel now? Have you changed attitude toward, I think that day perhaps you might just have been a little overwhelmed because, as I said, you know, you never appeared that way to me to just to be that manner.
Well, William, probably not one of my finer moments in life, but let me tell you, the passion that was behind my my displeasure is still here. We've embarked on a record school construction program, and so far it's a $1.3 billion program where we're eliminating all current and projected overcrowding, air conditioning our schools and modernizing them. And adding seats, we've built. We're building 15 new schools and 11 additions. So one of them was on this school site that we had already owned and was in place well before the condos were built around it. Frankly, I've never seen seniors heckle children about a school in their neighborhood before, and I was kind of taken off center by that. And they were extremely rude you know, it was almost like a get off my lawn kid type of moment there coming from these folks. Very disrespectful. And, you know, obviously I'm a human being and I was upset over that. But I still believe in what we did and that school's doing great. William, I also want to talk to you about what you were just saying in terms of working at the county. I've worked very hard in the past 5 years to increase the diversity of our county's workforce. For example, our police and fire departments now are, each recruit class in 5 years has been 40% non-white male. We've promoted from within the rank and file. Our fire department has more females than any large fire department in the country. Our police department has... made tremendous strides, and our number two police officer happens to be African American as well. But it's very important. Our workforce too, our department heads, we're 40% non-white male in terms of our department heads. My senior staff is more than 40% non-white male, and I think that's very important to set that standard because if we want the public to have confidence in decisions that we make, it needs to reflect the diversity of the community that we serve. So we're making great strides.
William, thanks for that call. We're going to take a short break. 410-319-8888 is the number. Grace, you're the next caller up. When we come back, there's a tweet from Dan Freeman we're going to read. Stay with us for the questions. 410-319-8888 for Kevin Kamenetz, who is, I was going to say running. No, he is the Baltimore County Executive. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm here with Kevin Kamenetz, Baltimore County Executive, and you at 410-319-8888. You can email us at talk@steinershow.org. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. We got a tweet coming in looking for emails. We do have lots of calls coming in, 410-319-8888. And Grace, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Grace.
How you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And, you know, I was listening to your program. It's really nice, and I'm so proud of you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Because how do you know she's not talking to me? I'm sorry, Grace.
That's okay.
That's okay, Grace. Go ahead.
Just continue doing what you're doing. I was brought up to help my people, and I'm a person of color. I was brought up to help the blacks and people of color. And I've been doing, I was targeted for the past 4 years for the work I do. I've been teaching black history from over 47 years free, teaching my black children trades. So when they got out there, they'd be able to do something if they didn't have a job, keep from getting in trouble. Feeding the hungry, starting feeding 300 people a year, went up to 1,600 without a grant or anything. Just God helping me. and also giving out over 383 pieces of furniture to the poor and the needy, plus giving clothes and everything.
Okay.
Everything's free, and getting my black officials elected. And some of them, when they get in the office, they don't speak to you.
Do you have a question for the county executive?
Huh?
Do you have a question for the county executive?
No, I don't have a question for him. I have a question for a lot of them in Baltimore City. I lived out in the county. I hate to say this. I moved to the county. They treated me better than the people did in the city of Baltimore.
Well, Grace, I appreciate the call and the comment about Baltimore County.
Come on back, Grace.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go to Carol in Baltimore County. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, how you doing?
Very well. Good morning.
Great. I heard a lot of passion with the county exec, and I'm excited about living in the county, and I've been in the county for about 25 years, so I don't have a lot of complaints. I just have one comment. Hopefully Mr. Kavanaugh will be running for governor at some point or even considering it, and if he did run for governor, how would he address some of the issues that are going on in Baltimore City in terms of lifting up the blighted communities and helping some of the people in those areas? That's my only question. Thank you for having me speak.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Carol. I'm very concerned about what's going on in the city, and I think what happened a year ago in the unrest really was a great opportunity for Baltimore County to be more of a regional player in recognizing that we are all one region. Unless Donald Trump comes into Baltimore and builds a wall around the city and make the city pay for it, I think we have to recognize that we are neighbors who need to work well together. And we've been focusing on that. So, you know, Baltimore County are very good contributors to the cultural institutions that happen to be located in the city, and we continue to do that. But we also now recognize the role we need to play in terms of providing more affordable housing for people, access to jobs, and better transportation links. I think, frankly, Governor Hogan does not come from the Baltimore area and really is not familiar with the needs of the area. I don't get a comfort level listening to him or watching his actions there. It's more headline stuff and almost reactive, but not well thought through. So he comes bursting in 6 months ago and says, okay, well, we're going to tear down the jail. It's broke. It needs to be fixed. And they say, well, did you read the General Assembly report about, you know, the years of planning and what might need to be done? He says, I don't need to read any reports. We're shutting this down today. And of course, he had no plan to try and focus on where to go from there. 6 months later, he comes before this General Assembly session and he says, okay, well, now I'm coming through with money to rebuild the jail. And we're going to do it faster and quicker and cheaper. He says, but we're going to do it at the expense of three college buildings at Morgan State, where we're sitting right now, at UMES and UMBC. So it's a choice. Either we build a jail or we build college buildings, but we're not going to be able to do both. So I'm moving ahead with the building of the jail. And, of course, the members of the General Assembly were quite disturbed over that, and he immediately backed off, and he said, okay, fine, we won't build a jail. So now he still has no game plan on what he's going to do in terms of improving the conditions of the people who are in the jail. But there's no thoughtfulness to it. You know, in his prerogative, he had the right to cancel the red line. He's the governor. He could do that, I guess. But what I faulted him for was not having any plan B, and we're still stuck in traffic. His transportation secretary says, well, Baltimore's just a bus town, whatever that's supposed to mean. Still no game plan here. And the worst part is that he took all of the money that was devoted toward mass transit solutions for the Baltimore region and dispersed it to dubious rural road projects all across the state. That, again, showed an absolute disregard for the needs of the Baltimore region and a bit of spitefulness to take the money away. So in response, the General Assembly just passed a bill that says, you know what, before you sit there and spend all this money on transportation projects, because your own transportation secretary couldn't even articulate how decisions were made, we want you to follow what is done in by Republican assembly in North Carolina and Republican assembly in Virginia to create a score touring project so that we can see how you make these decisions. So the it still allows the governor full sway, but if the governor deviates from the scoring system, he has to justify it. So Governor Hogan vetoes that bill right away and now and calls it again blatant power grab and, you know, not accountable. I mean, just totally off the mark. This bill only happened because of his failure to recognize the needs of Baltimore Region. So I think what we need is the opportunity for people to have a better sense of how we move people forward in this region. Don't blow them off. Don't say this is just a bus town. Don't say they don't need opportunities for mass transit to attract the choice rider. Don't sit there and say you have to choose a jail versus a college building. That's what I think we need to have better discussion about.
Kevin Kamenetz is Baltimore County Executive, 410-319-8888. Thanks for that call. I'm going to get this tweet, but first let's go to Bertha, on Liberty Road, and then we will go to this tweet. Bertha, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Kamenetz.
Good morning.
We're one of your biggest supporters. We're in the Liberty Crest area right up above the Woodmore Shopping Center.
Well, you know I grew up near there. I know that neighborhood well.
I know you did. But we seem to be forgotten sometimes with things that we need to get done. We report things, but nothing gets done about them. We have a strip mall, you know, there at Liberty Crest that they put trash in the alley and all these kind of things. We reported them to code enforcement. Our streets need repaving. They say they're not bad enough, but if your streets look bad, it makes your neighborhood look bad. So there are a lot of things that we keep reporting to try to make our area better. We have some good homeowners, but we can't get a lot of help from the county. And we're a little bit concerned about that we may be getting forgotten in all of the things that are going on.
But we
do support you, and we thank you.
Ms. Bertha, thank you very much. And if you're concerned, I'm even more concerned. So I want you to call my office, 410-887-2450, and I want you to ask for Don, D-O-N. And that's my chief of staff, and I want you to talk to him directly and then give us your list, and we'll try and follow through, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Bertha. Well, before we get to next caller is Gary in White Marsh. We're going to come to your call in a minute. There's a tweet in from Dan Freeman. Dan tweets in, what is the county's plan if the county council doesn't fund the 1,000 affordable housing units? Now, to follow up with that, I mean, that's an interesting question that he raised. The lawsuit from 2011, Baltimore County, NAACP, BNI, and three county residents sued the county for lack of affordability for homes in the county and to open up vouchers for people to be able to move into the county. So I'm curious. So where do you take this from here? And, well, let you start first before I ask another question.
First of all, in today's paper, there's a nice little Oriole article, preview article on opening day from my friend Ray Burke, who's an attorney. And he talks about Frank Robinson coming here as this great hero in 1966, but having no place to live. I'm glad he worked that into the article today because it talks about the segregation that has taken place in the county and the city. Several years ago, I read the book by former Sun editorial writer Antero Pietella, Not in My Backyard.
Right.
Yeah. Not in My Neighborhood. And I thought, wow, for the first time after reading that book, for the first time someone actually put it all together. You knew Jews weren't allowed in Roland Park, and you knew there were all these segregated areas where blacks couldn't go and Italians couldn't go. You had a Little Italy, you had a Greek town and a Highland town, and it really put into a written format that this was a planned and structured effort at segregation. And I thought that was really helpful. And those same patterns, of course, extended into Baltimore County. The April unrest took place, and it was, again, a good opportunity to sit there and focus on what is our responsibility today. So I'm happy that we were able to enter into a settlement with HUD, and this was brought in early 2011 at the beginning of my term, and it wasn't anything that occurred during my term, but it was really a reflection of the patterns, housing patterns that are discriminatory that have existed for generations in Baltimore County. So what we're trying to do is recognize that you can't have concentrations of poverty anywhere and allow those citizens to be successful. It's just very challenging. In 1994, when I first ran for county council, HUD wanted to pursue the MTO program, Movement to Opportunity, which really created an ugly outcry on the east side of the county, and ultimately HUD backed off. Where they were allowing opportunities for people to move from concentrated areas of poverty in the city into Baltimore County, where conceivably it's better, better, lower crime rates and better schools. So, interestingly, though, MTO was advanced in other jurisdictions across the country, and that was 20 years ago. 10 years later, they did a study, and they said, "Okay, how did the families do?" From those who remained in the urban jurisdiction and those who moved to the suburban jurisdiction, they did not detect a really noticeable difference in the quality of life or outcomes for them. But then they went back 20 years later, and they found that maybe the parents were still the same, but it was the children who succeeded remarkably in the suburban communities. They were affluent, educated, and well-off, you know, doing much better in their lives than the control group in the city. And that was a really good eye-opener for me as well, because it validated that if given the opportunity, people can move up, but if they are stuck within limited expectations and circumstances where in high concentrations of poverty, they're not going to achieve.
But this
is what we're looking at to do in Baltimore County.
So we have Baltimore County that back in Dale Anderson's day and before, in Agnew's day,
where they proudly emphasized that city blacks were not welcome in the county.
Exactly, yes. We're very clear about it. And even the former governor Ehrlich in MTO,
he was involved in MTO,
and kind of stopping that from happening. Reminiscent of a little bit of Trump, but the question is now Baltimore County was then like 3% African American. Now it's almost 40% people of color, of Latino, Black, and other communities of color in Baltimore County. So that's changing. Baltimore County is changing. But the question is, when you have a city council, a county council, that is going to vote most likely not to require landlords to accept vouchers and developers to have these set-asides. So what's your political plan? If the majority of the council is opposed to opening up the county in that way, in areas that are not already poor working-class communities in the county, but in other areas, how do you do that? I mean, so what's your political plan?
There's a multi-pronged approach. First of all, we have a $30 million fund that's set aside that the administration will be able to forward to participating developers who would like to have mixed-use facilities. That is, basically, it's buying down the cost of certain units, provided that they then set that aside for more affordable housing. We like the idea of mixed use because we don't want to recreate new concentrations of poverty, and we think that will be successful there. We also have committed to creating 1,000 hard units over the next dozen years that will also be brand new affordable housing in specific census tracts that don't already have high concentrations of African-American poverty. That's very important as well, and we move forward with that again administratively as opposed to anything legislatively. We also are creating a mobility counseling program so that when we do have families that wish to relocate here in Baltimore County, we provide all types of counseling services to make sure that they can successfully assimilate into a new community. The last piece of the puzzle is what we call source of income legislation, where it says that a landlord, when considering the income of a prospective tenant, cannot discriminate based upon receipt of Social Security benefits, disability benefits, Section 8, what we call euphemistically Section 8 housing benefits. That bill has failed every year in the General Assembly, but we are committed to supporting that here in Baltimore County, and we'll be introducing a bill if nothing passes in the General Assembly. That is subject to council vote. I hope the council supports it.
But all indications are they won't.
Well, I we've had some general conversations with them. We have not tried to pin down specific votes yet, but we're going to start that dialogue shortly.
410-319-8888. Gary and White Marsh, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I'll call Mark, and a pleasant good morning to you and to county executives.
Good morning, Gary.
Good morning. Mr. Cavanaugh, my concern is for – I had a question about the development, controlled development in the White Marsh area. I've worked in the county and just retired after 33 wonderful years with Baltimore County.
Are you getting our check every month?
Yeah, I am, and I'm thankful for that. Thank you very much. It comes exactly on time. And I've enjoyed my experience with Baltimore County and my work there.
What department were you in?
I was in Public Works Utilities.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, with Ed Adams, and worked with Ed for many, many years, probably the same amount of years as he's been with the county. And I know that he's retiring soon, so I wish him well.
We all do. Thank you.
Absolutely. What I was looking at is the development in the White Marsh area, an area where I live, and I guess what I'm considering the controlled development of this area. Because when you look at roads like Callington Avenue, Ebenezer, Campbell Boulevard, and Philadelphia Road as one of the main arteries, the infrastructure, I would think, needs to be a solid and long-term infrastructure to support the development that's going to be happening in this area. And I know you've done a great job in keeping the parks, keeping certain areas for parks, and I really appreciate that. What are your plans to make sure that we have the infrastructure that supports the development that certainly will come?
Well, I just had a meeting with Ed Adams last month, and we were talking about Campbell Boulevard and how we're moving forward with a connection that will lead right to Route 43. But, coming from Public Works, you can appreciate that we have to invest in infrastructure, and those are highways. And we are doing that. But we're also, and you talked about the parks we've been doing in the Honeygo area as well, including a new dog park there, as well as recreational centers. We anticipate constructing two new elementary schools in that region as well that will handle accommodate future housing growth as well. It's a desirable area of town. People want to live there. The projected development has been planned for decades, and it's just we're just working on kind of finishing that up, and the roads are going to follow as well.
Thank you so much.
Gary, thanks for your call.
Enjoy your retirement, Gary.
Yeah. Congratulations. Let's go back to the phones of 410-319-8888. Bernard in Baltimore County, you're on the air.
Thank you, Mark, for bringing the timely conversation on the phone today.
My pleasure.
Over there. I have a couple of three things. Number one, I don't know how true it is, but I've heard that the council executives have proposed an increase in the water bill of Baltimore County. Is that true?
Yeah, Bernard, we actually talked about that before earlier in the program. Basically, the Metropolitan District Fund is a separate self-supporting fund. And on the annual property tax bill, you see a separate sewer charge, and that's that goes toward the infrastructure. These are the pipes and sewers underground that sometimes fail. You hear about sinkholes. You hear about wastewater being dumped into the streams. When those occur, it's because it's a failure of the infrastructure. We've committed to upgrading that. We don't want a Flint, Michigan situation. We want to make sure that we have a solid system that we don't have these types of catastrophes. Unfortunately, because it has to be self-supporting, it means we have to put the money in as we go and make those improvements and not kick the can down the road, and that's what we're committed to doing.
Bernard, we only have a couple minutes left, so what's your next question so we can get a quick answer?
I've been here, I hear 44 years. This is the worst I've had when this blizzard came this year, February. We couldn't get any results, and now that right in back of me, it's a new development, and but it started snowing Friday night evening. They were out there putting salt out. That's all we wanted, and I'm on a bus route. And then that Sunday after the snow, the sun came out, the Sunday sun came out on the front page about preferential treatment, you know, like, say, in Pikesville or
Nah, none of that's true. But listen, this snow, this was the highest accumulation of any single storm in the history of Baltimore County. I recognize that our citizens are frustrated. We have 8,800 lane miles that we have to maintain with snow coverage. Our folks work very hard. Can we always improve on our performance? Absolutely. Have we used this as a learning experience to get even better? Yes. So I hope by next winter, when we get that next storm, you know, Bernard, that will be better. But Bernard, it's really hard to talk about snow on opening day.
You might have to talk about rain on opening day.
Yeah.
that's possible.
But Bernard, we're going to keep working hard for you, okay?
So I guess just about out of time here. So I want to thank County Executive Cabinets for coming in. Kevin, good to see you.
All right. So look, let's talk about this. I predict over 90 wins. All right.
Orioles.
Over. Yeah, of course. What else can we be talking about right now? Over 90 wins.
Over 90 wins.
Yes.
Starting with today.
Yes. Yes, we will win today. We generally somehow, I think our opening day record is pretty strong at Camden Yards, but I'm really excited. Look, Peter Angelos has really, really stepped up to the plate, pardon the pun, and put up a lot of money this year. And I think the fans need to really feel good about this and come on out. We got a great team.
Kevin Kamenetz, have fun at the game.
Yeah, thanks.
Enjoy yourself today. Good to have you in the studio. Thanks so much.
Good to see you again, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you all for calling in and writing and making the show what it is. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Sienna Greaves, Morgan Barber, Manifa Wilson, and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. The podcast, Mark Steiner Show. Share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org or visit us on via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Go O's.